I want you to just take a second and think about a time, maybe like very recently, when you had to craft the absolute perfect message.
Oh, yeah, we've all been there.
Right. Like, just picture the scenario. Maybe it was this, high stakes email to a client who has just been consistently misinterpreting your work for weeks.
Or, a text to a partner.
Yes, exactly. Like, you're in the middle of a really tense, ongoing argument, and you know that just one wrong syllable is going to ignite this massive fight.
The pressure is just, it's immense.
It really is. So you sit there staring at the screen, right? You type a sentence, you delete three words, you add a caveat.
You might even pull up a thesaurus.
Totally. I mean, you make the language as precise and defensive and just bulletproof as humanly possible, and you finally hit send.
And then, we know what happens next.
Right. The recipient completely misunderstands you anyway. They take it in the exact wrong way and they apply it to the situation in a manner you just never intended.
It is so infuriating.
It's maddening. And you sit there asking yourself, why does language always seem to fail us right at the exact moment we put the most effort into making it perfect?
Well, we constantly experience this. And I think the immediate aftermath is almost always this wave of intense self-blame.
Oh, for sure. Like, I should have phrased that better.
Right, because the instinct is to view communication as a purely mechanical process. Like, if the machine breaks down, we just assume it's user error.
Yeah, we tell ourselves, like, if I had just used a slightly more specific adjective or maybe appended one more clause to that text, they would have gotten it.
Exactly. We operate under this, frankly, false assumption that flawless communication is entirely possible, provided we just try hard enough and find the exact right vocabulary.
We treat language like this totally frictionless surface, and any friction is just, well, our own fault.
But today, we are going to completely dismantle that assumption.
Yes, we are. We are doing a deep dive into an incredibly dense, but honestly groundbreaking paper by C.F. Dietz.
It really is a paradigm shift.
It is. The paper is titled Semantic Remainder: The Language Uncertainty Principle as a Closure Theorem.
Quite a mouthful, I know.
It is, but our mission today is to take this brilliant 50-year-old idea that has sort of been treated as a loose poetic metaphor for decades, and we're going to look at how Dietz proves it is actually a hard structural law of human communication.
Yeah, Dietz is making a massive claim here. He basically argues that no linguistic expression, whether that's, a single spoken sentence, a three-page email, or like a complex federal statute,
Right.
none of them can simultaneously maximize two fundamental properties.
And we really need to nail these properties down.
Definitely. He calls them definitional precision, which is essentially the abstract dictionary meaning of a word, and contextual fidelity, which is the specific localized meaning of that word in a unique real-world moment.
So we need to unpack this right away because Dietz is arguing this isn't just a symptom of like sloppy speaking
Yeah,
or
great.
a limited vocabulary. He's arguing for a mathematical style impossibility, right?
Yes, it is a structural law that dictates the absolute boundaries of what humans can actually do with words.
And it impacts literally everything. I mean, we are going to see how this invisible law shapes the legal system you live under, how it distorts the science news you read.
Which is fascinating on its own.
Oh, completely. And incredibly, how it alters the actual physical neurobiology of your body when a doctor delivers a diagnosis.
It's mind-blowing. But to understand how Dietz builds this structural law, we really have to clear away some historical baggage first.
Right, let's talk about the history, because the term language uncertainty principle, or the LUP, has been around for a while.
Yeah, it's been floating around academic linguistics and philosophy since about 1975.
Wow, okay.
But for half a century, it was largely dismissed. People just treated it as a cute analogy to Werner Heisenberg's famous uncertainty principle in quantum physics.
Okay, right. So just as a quick refresher, Heisenberg's principle says that you cannot simultaneously know both the exact position and the exact momentum of a quantum particle. Like, the more tightly you pin down the particle's position, the less you can possibly know about where it's going.
And people looked at language and thought, oh, that sounds similar.
Right. They thought the more tightly you pin down a word's definition, the less you know about its context.
Which sounds nice, but
But if you're a philosopher of language, that has got to be a deeply frustrating comparison.
it drove him crazy.
I mean, words are not electrons, right? Language isn't made of quantum particles governed by wave functions. So, of course, the physics analogy caused academics to dismiss the whole thing.
Yeah, it was a metaphor doing way more heavy lifting than a metaphor should really be allowed to do.
So if Dietz is throwing out the Heisenberg physics analogy, how does he actually prove this principle?
Well, Dietz recognizes that failure immediately. The paper explicitly abandons all that quantum physics baggage. To prove the LUP is a structural theorem, he introduces a totally new framework.
Drawn from his broader work, right? Consciousness, closure, and the cosmos.
That's the one. And the entire theorem rests on two foundational interlocking concepts.
Okay, lay them on me.
Linguistic closure and semantic remainder.
All right, let's define those really clearly for everyone listening, because if we don't understand these two concepts, like, the rest of this deep dive won't make any sense.
Let's start with linguistic closure. In Dietz's framework, every single time you formulate an expression, you are performing a closure operation.
A closure operation, meaning what exactly?
Meaning you are drawing a boundary around meaning. Think about it before you speak. Your experience of a moment is just this undifferentiated chaos of sensory inputs.
Oh, sure. Memories, emotions, sights, sounds.
Exactly. But by choosing specific words, you stabilize a tiny fraction of that semantic content. You fix certain distinctions in place, and by doing so, you create a communicable fact.
Okay, so without that closure, you just can't share information at all. You just have your own private, unformed experience.
Right. You have to close the boundary to hand the thought to someone else.
Okay, so if we are, like, sitting in a coffee shop and I say to you, the cup is on the table, I have performed a closure.
Yes, a very specific one.
Because out of all the music playing and the smell of the espresso and the weird conversation at the next table and the thousands of other objects in the room, I drew a strict boundary.
You ignored almost everything in the room to make that sentence.
Right. I established a relationship between a cup and a table. I stabilized that one tiny piece of reality.
You drew a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And that boundary brings us directly to the critical second half of the equation, which is semantic remainder.
The remainder, what's left over.
Exactly. By the very act of drawing that boundary to create your sentence about the cuck, you inherently leave everything else out.
You sort of underspecify the reality of the whole room.
Yes, you actively suppress other information just to make the sentence functional.
Mm-hmm.
The things that fall outside the linguistic boundary you just drew, it is the semantic remainder.
Okay, I want to give a visual analogy here for everyone listening because this helped me so much.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Think of it like taking a photograph. Imagine you are standing in this sprawling, incredibly dense, ancient forest. The sensory input is totally overwhelming, but you have a camera and you spot one specific beautiful moss-covered tree.
Just the one tree.
Right. The moment you lift that camera, look through the viewfinder, and put a frame around that single tree, you are achieving closure. You are capturing a stabilized fact.
I like this.
But by doing that, you are actively structurally turning the entire rest of the surrounding forest, the other trees, the sky, the ground behind you into remainder.
Yes.
And the stuff outside the frame isn't a mistake you made as a photographer. It's actual proof that a frame exists at all.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And taking that analogy even further, notice what happens to the tree you did capture.
What do you mean?
Well, by isolating it within the frame, you've completely disconnected it from the root system it shares with the forest. You've stripped away the context that actually allows it to survive.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
So the remainder is structural proof of the frame. It is not a sign of an imprecise speaker. Any grammar that draws a distinction must, by definition, leave other distinctions undrawn.
So semantic remainder is just the inevitable, inescapable byproduct of using a finite communication system to describe an infinite reality.
Beautifully said. Yes.
Okay, so now that we know every single sentence we utter generates this remainder, we need to look at the two specific dimensions of language that are constantly fighting over what gets left out.
Right. Dietz argues that linguistic closure operates across two irreducible dimensions.
And these are the definitional dimension and the contextual dimension.
Yes, and these two forces are completely opposed to one another in their demands on the sentence. They are in a constant, endless tug of war.
Let's break down the definitional dimension first.
Yeah.
This is like the abstract, context-independent meaning of a word.
Exactly. Yeah. It's what you find in a dictionary.
It's the property that allows a word to travel across time, across space, across totally different situations, and still retain a core intelligibility.
Right, like the word vehicle
has
a set definition.
But to maximize that definitional power, you actually have to strip away the specific situation you are currently in.
Yes. A definition relies on ignoring immediate circumstances. It needs to be sterile so that it can be portable.
Right, sterile so it can travel. But then you have the contextual dimension.
And this is the situational force of the word right now, in this exact moment, in this exact room, between two specific people.
So to maximize the contextual dimension, you must attend specifically to the speaker's exact circumstances, like their relationships, their history, the tone of their voice.
The unspoken, shared assumptions in the room. All of it.
So the definitional dimension is asking, what does this mean anywhere to anyone? While the contextual dimension is asking, what does this mean right here, right now, between you and me?
Exactly. And here is where Deitz reveals the structural impossibility at the heart of the theorem.
Here we go.
It is formally impossible to minimize remainder in both of these dimensions simultaneously.
You just can't do it.
You can't. An expression that is perfectly stable across all contexts, like a pure, definitive, dictionary-style statement, is, by definition, stabilized against contextual variation.
It survives the journey to the next moment by actively ignoring the nuances of the present moment.
Right. It has to wear armor to travel, but that armor makes it completely numb to the environment it is standing in.
Oh, I love that phrasing. Armor that makes it numb.
And conversely, an expression that is perfectly molded to this exact second in time, you know, highly sensitive to every microscopic nuance of your current relationship and environment, it cannot be universally stable.
Because its meaning relies entirely on the temporary, fleeting architecture of that present moment.
Exactly. You cannot simultaneously optimize a sentence to be perfectly context-independent and perfectly context-dependent. They are competing, mutually exclusive demands on a finite operation.
Okay, wait. I need to stop you there, because I am immediately thinking of a counter-strategy.
Let's hear it.
If I know this law exists, why can't I just defeat it with extreme verbosity?
Ah, the brute force approach.
Yeah. Let's say I'm writing a contract or even just an incredibly important email. Why can't I just brute force my way out of this uncertainty principle by using thousands and thousands of words?
You mean just covering every base?
Right. I could just keep adding qualifications, caveats, exceptions, and highly technical terms until I have perfectly mapped both the definitional core and every possible contextual scenario.
Sounds logical.
Look at Apple's terms of service, you know. They are like 50 pages long. Are you telling me their army of corporate lawyers hasn't successfully eliminated the semantic remainder?
It is the most natural instinct we have when faced with ambiguity. We just inherently believe that sheer precision is the antidote.
We really do. We think more words equal less remainder.
But Deitz devotes a significant portion of his paper to dismantling this exact assumption. Adding precision does not reduce the total volume of semantic remainder.
It doesn't.
No, it merely redistributes it.
How does 50 pages of incredibly dense legal text not reduce the remainder? I mean, they cover every conceivable situation.
Because every time you add a new technical term or insert a new hyper-specific caveat to make your definition tighter, you are drawing a new boundary.
Yeah.
And every new boundary creates a new edge. You are simultaneously introducing entirely new contextual ambiguity about exactly when, how, and if that new caveat applies to the lived reality of the user.
Okay, let me think through an example. So if I add a clause to a contract that says, this applies unless extreme weather occurs.
Right.
I feel like I've made the definition more precise. I've covered a loophole.
But in reality, you've just shifted the uncertainty.
Because now the context is screaming, wait, what counts as extreme weather right now in this specific county for this specific project?
Exactly.
Like, does a heavy thunderstorm count, or does it literally have to be a named hurricane?
You haven't eliminated the remainder at all. You took a broad definitional remainder, and you shattered it into a dozen highly specific contextual remainders.
Oh, wow.
The total volume of uncertainty in the system hasn't changed one bit. You've just changed its location and its flavor.
So the lawyers writing a 50-page terms of service haven't defeated the LUP at all.
No, they've just created a phenomenally complex web of contextual remainders that require judges and courts to interpret when real life inevitably collides with the text. The theorem holds at every single level of precision.
That is wild. Now, because this concept operates at such a foundational level of human thought, it is incredibly easy to conflate it with other famous theories.
Yes, and Deitz spends time clearing the brush, drawing strict borders around what he is claiming and what he is definitively not claiming.
We should probably do the same so people don't get lost.
Good idea. Deitz explicitly distances his theorem from three major concepts that readers constantly confuse it with. We touched on the first one, but it requires a deeper final nail in the coffin.
Right. It is absolutely not Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Exactly. Heisenberg is a physical theorem about the behavior of particles at a subatomic scale. It has a precise mathematical numerical bound regarding physical measurement.
While Dietz's LUP is a logical impossibility bound regarding semantic structure.
Right. It is about competing demands on a finite communicative closure. It has absolutely nothing to do with physical measurement or observing a physical object.
Applying physics to semantics is a category error that Dietz just wholly rejects.
100%. Now, the second concept Dietz separates from is fascinating. It's W.V.O. Quine's famous theory of the indeterminacy of translation.
Okay, can we spend some time on this? Because Quine's theory is mind-bending, but we need to see why Dietz says it's actually a completely different problem.
Let's do it. Quine's thought experiment is legendary in philosophy. Imagine a linguist who travels to an isolated society to study a completely foreign language, one with absolutely no historical connection to any known language.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
The linguist is standing in a clearing with a native speaker. Suddenly, a rabbit scurries past them in the grass. The native speaker points at the animal and yells, "Gavagai!"
Right, so the natural assumption for the linguist is to write down in their little notebook, "Gavagai equals rabbit."
Exactly, it seems so obvious. But Quine argues that you can never know for absolute certain if Gavagai actually means rabbit as a whole singular object.
Wait, what else could it mean?
Well, what if, in their conceptual framework, Gavagai means undetached rabbit parts.
Undetached rabbit parts, like just a collection of ears and paws moving together.
Yes. Mm. Or what if it translates to a temporal event, like a rabbit-like instance is occurring?
Oh, wow.
Or what if it simply means food is running?
Okay, yeah, because the physical behavior of pointing at the grass and the physical presence of the animal perfectly match literally all of those potential translations.
Exactly. The meaning is underdetermined by the behavioral evidence. Quine argues there are multiple completely incompatible translation manuals that could all fit the physical data perfectly.
And there's no objective fact of the matter about which one is truly correct.
Right.
Which is terrifying for anyone who studies language. But here is the crucial distinction that separates Quine from Dietz. Quine's theory is entirely about the interpreter. It is a problem of epistemology how you, looking at someone else from the outside, can ever truly know what they mean.
While Dietz's LUP is about the speaker making their own sentence.
That is the dividing line right there. Quine is looking at the gap between two different minds. Dietz is looking at the internal structural mechanics of the closure operation itself within a single mind.
Yes. So even if I am sitting alone in an empty room talking to myself.
With zero translation issues, zero cultural barriers.
Complete access to my own thoughts. The language uncertainty principle still traps me.
Because when I form a sentence in my own head, I still have to force my infinite chaotic thought through the narrow funnel of a finite closure.
Exactly. You still have to choose between stabilizing the definition or honoring the context of your current mental state. The LUP applies before translation even begins.
Okay, that makes total sense. And that leads to the third thing Dietz clarifies, right?
Yes, the LUP is not just ordinary semantic ambiguity.
Right, this isn't a theory about puns. It's not about words that just happen to have two meanings by accident.
Like the word bank.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Bank can mean the muddy side of a river, or it can mean the brick building that holds your money.
Lexical ambiguity like that is just a contingent accident of history. We just happen to use the exact same sound for two totally different things.
And you can fix that instantly by adding one word, right? Just say financial bank or river bank, and the remainder disappears.
But the LUP applies to perfectly unambiguous words, too.
Like the word oxygen. It has a very specific singular meaning.
Exactly. Even if a word has only one crystal clear scientific definition, it still generates remainder.
Why?
Because that crystal clear definition must, by its very nature, abstract away from the situational reality of the moment. The word oxygen in a textbook is definitionally perfect.
Right.
But the word oxygen, shouted by a scuba diver whose tank is suddenly failing, that has a massive contextual dimension that the dictionary definition cannot possibly capture.
Oh, that's a great example. So the LUP is a structural law of all finite closure, not just some quirk of how the English language evolved. Okay, so we have isolated the theory. We know it's a hard structural law about the impossibility of perfect language. We've separated it from physics, from translation problems, from simple vocabulary quirks.
Now, we need to see this theorem operating in the wild.
Yes. We need to see how this invisible tug of war between definition and context shapes the actual information you interact with every single day.
And a great place to start is scientific communication.
Okay, let's look at that. Dietz points to a deeply revealing study by medical researchers Woolishin and Schwartz, right?
Yes. They systematically tracked the life cycle of medical findings. They basically watched how language morphed as it traveled from the original highly controlled clinical trials to university press releases and finally onto mainstream news broadcasts and digital media.
Okay, let's trace that path because it really proves the point. Imagine a study on a new compound and its effect on cellular health. In the original clinical trial, published in some peer-reviewed journal, the language is exhaustively contextual. It reads something like, in a cohort of 400 males aged 60 to 65 with pre-existing markers for condition X, oral administration of 50 milligrams of compound Y over 6 months was associated with a 4.2% change in biomarker Z, yielding a p-value of 0.04.
That sentence is practically vibrating with contextual remainder for anyone outside the scientific community.
Right. It is heavily weighted toward the contextual pole.
But as that finding moves to the university press office, the communicators have to widen the audience. So the language shifts.
Associated with a 4.2% change becomes may reduce the risk of.
And by the time it hits a morning news broadcast or the viral social media post, the contextual anchors are entirely severed.
The headline just blares, compound Y reduces disease, or worse, compound Y cures disease.
Right. Now, the standard cultural critique of this process is just cynicism. We say the media is aggressively dumbing things down, or journalists are intentionally sensationalizing science for clicks.
Or that the public is just too scientifically illiterate to handle the truth.
But when you look at it through the lens of the language uncertainty principle, a much deeper structural reality emerges. The press isn't just maliciously dumbing it down.
The communicative pressure of broadcasting a single message to millions of diverse people forces a massive gravitational pull toward the definitional pole.
Exactly. A morning news show needs language that is stable, instantly transportable, and immediately understandable for a mass audience spread across entirely different contexts.
And the LUP mathematically dictates that you have to pay a price for that widespread definitional stability.
And the price is paid in massive contextual remainder. By making the headline definitionally robust and easily digestible, they structurally have to strip away the specific population data, the p-value thresholds, the clinical conditions.
You just cannot broadcast a perfectly contextualized 1,000-page clinical trial to 10 million people without the communication collapsing under its own weight.
But you also cannot broadcast a definitionally pure 5-word headline without sacrificing the contextual truth of the lab.
It's not a failure of journalism at all. It's the structural boundary of language at scale.
Yes. And this identical tension completely dominates the legal system, too.
Oh, this is fascinating. Law is perhaps the purest attempt humanity has made to conquer semantic remainder.
And Dietz shows how it continually fails. He invokes H.L.A. Hart's legendary thought experiment from the philosophy of law. It's known as the vehicle in a park scenario.
I love this one. Okay, imagine a town council decides they want to keep their local park quiet and safe. So they pass a statute that simply reads, no vehicles in the park.
Seems simple enough.
On its face, when they write it, the definitional meaning seems rock solid. Everyone knows what a vehicle is. The legislature has optimized for definitional precision so the law can be applied equally to all citizens.
Right. Today, tomorrow, and 10 years from now. But then real-world context inevitably collides with the definition.
What happened?
Well, a local veterans group petitions to install a decommissioned World War II tank in the center of the park as a permanent memorial.
Okay, so is a tank a vehicle?
Yes, definitionally. But contextually, it's a statue. Does the law ban it?
That's tricky. What about a mother pushing a baby carriage through the park? A carriage has wheels and transports a human being. Definitionally, that meets the criteria of a vehicle.
Or a teenager on a motorized hoverboard.
What if an elderly man has a heart attack on a park bench and an ambulance drives over the grass to save his life?
The town council, by anchoring so heavily to the definitional pole of no vehicles, rendered the law completely blind to the contextual remainder it just generated.
The definition literally cannot adapt to the lived reality of the park.
And Dietz takes this local park problem and scales it all the way up to the grandest debate in American law, constitutional interpretation.
This is where it gets so real, because when you map the LUP onto the Supreme Court, you realize that the massive generation-defining fight between originalism and living constitutionalism is, at its core, just a fierce debate about how to manage semantic remainder.
It is a stunning reframing of how we view the courts. And I should clarify, Dietz isn't taking a political side here.
Right, and neither are we. We are just looking at the mechanics of the language.
Exactly. So if you subscribe to originalism, you believe that the Constitution should be interpreted based on its original public meaning at the exact time it was written.
Okay, so in Dietz's framework, originalism is an attempt to minimize contextual remainder by rigidly anchoring the text to a historical definitional meaning.
Yes, originalists want the definition to be as stable and unmoving as possible, completely insulated from the shifting context of modern society.
But by doing that, originalism inherently generates massive remainder in the opposite dimension.
Right. Take the Second Amendment. If you lock down the definition of arms to exactly what a citizen would have understood in 1791, you know, muskets and cannons, you generate enormous contextual friction when you are forced to apply that 18th century definition to 21st century realities.
Like autonomous drone swarms or 3D printed ghost guns or cyber weapons, the definition is totally stable, but the context is chaotic.
Exactly. Now, on the other side, you have the living constitution approach. This philosophy argues that the meaning of constitutional text should evolve and adapt to changing societal circumstances and moral standards.
So this approach is trying to minimize definitional remainder in order to achieve high contextual fidelity to modern situations. They want the law to mold to the reality we live in right now.
But the LUP strikes again. By allowing definitions to be fluid and shift based on current context, living constitutionalism generates massive remainder in the definitional dimension.
It sacrifices the very stability, predictability, and universal application that a fixed legal definition provides.
If the meaning of the law changes depending on the era, how can a citizen definitively know what is legal today versus tomorrow?
The core insight Dietz offers here is really sobering. The LUP structurally proves that this constitutional debate can never be permanently solved.
Never. Neither side can achieve ultimate victory because both sides are fighting against a mathematical property of finite language.
Every legal closure, no matter how brilliantly written, will generate remainder. You just cannot write a law that is perfectly stable across centuries and perfectly adaptable to unprecedented modern contexts.
The debate can only ever be managed day by day, case by case.
It reframes our entire political landscape. We aren't just arguing over policy. We are literally watching the physics of language play out in the highest courts.
It's incredible to think about.
Okay, so we've looked at massive macro institutions, science journalism, and the Supreme Court. But how does this invisible law affect you on a Tuesday night at a dinner party?
The everyday dance of conversation.
Yes. Let's talk about how we actually survive this linguistic tension in normal life.
Well, to explain how we navigate this daily, Dietz contrasts his LUP with the work of philosopher Paul Grice.
Grice! He's famous for the maxims of conversation, right?
Yes. Grice observed that for human communication to function at all, we must tacitly agree to a cooperative principle. His maxims dictate that when we speak, we should strive to be informative, truthful, relevant, and above all, clear.
So Grice is essentially telling us to push as hard as we can toward the definitional dimension, right? Be clear, be specific, leave no ambiguity.
Exactly. But let's put Grice's maxims to the test in a real-world scenario.
Let's do it.
Let's say you are hosting a dinner party. It is past midnight. You are exhausted. You have a massive presentation at work tomorrow. And there is one guest sitting on your couch who is completely oblivious to all social cues and just will not leave.
Oh, I've been there. It's the worst.
You walk into the living room, you sigh deeply, and you say, well, it is getting late.
Classic move.
If we strictly apply Grice's maxims of being clear, literal, and informative, if we only look at the definitional dimension of your sentence, you have just stated a chronological fact about the rotation of the earth.
Right. I have provided a temporal observation.
But the true intended meaning of that sentence, please, for the love of God, get out of my house so I can sleep, that meaning lives entirely in the contextual remainder.
The meaning is nowhere to be found in the literal words. We purposefully, strategically use a definitionally poor, incredibly vague sentence, and we rely entirely on the context of the room to do the heavy lifting.
The empty wine bottles, the heavy yawns, the shared cultural rules of etiquette. We use the remainder as a tool.
And this leads Dietz to engage with relevance theory, right?
Yes, developed by cognitive scientists Dan Sperber and Deirdre Wilson. Relevance theory is a model of mental processing. It explains how a listener actually bridges the gap between what is literally said and what is actually meant.
Because human brains are incredibly efficient engines.
Exactly. A listener will naturally scan the context and lock onto the interpretation that provides the maximum cognitive effect for the minimum processing effort.
So the oblivious guest hears, "It's getting late," and their brain subconsciously runs a quick calculation. They could assume I'm starting a philosophical debate about the nature of time.
But that takes a lot of mental effort and doesn't fit the context of you yawning by the door.
Right. So their brain calculates that inferring the host wants me to leave makes the most sense of the situation with the least amount of mental strain.
And relevance theory is a brilliant explanation of cognitive mechanics. But Dietz makes a crucial distinction here, and it is vital for understanding his entire thesis.
What's the distinction?
Relevance theory only explains how we navigate the gap between words and meaning. It explains the biological processing of the listener. But Dietz's LUP explains why the gap structurally exists in the first place.
Oh. Relevance theory takes the gap as a given. It basically assumes, well, human communication is messy. Here is how we survive it.
Right. Dietz is saying the gap isn't just an accident of sloppy dinner party conversation. The tension is structurally necessary.
Any finite closure operation must make a trade-off between definitional stability and contextual fidelity. Grice and Sperber explain how we survive the language uncertainty principle on a daily basis. Dietz mathematically maps the principle itself.
Exactly. We've established how this operates socially, but we really need to move into the most consequential section of Dietz's work.
Yes, the medical implications.
In his companion books, The Invisible Prescription and The Grammar of Healing, he takes the semantic remainder out of the realm of philosophy and dinner parties and drops it directly into clinical medicine.
This part is unbelievable. He proves that semantic remainder literally alters human biology.
It becomes a matter of life and death. Dietz focuses on the physician-patient encounter to show how linguistic closure physically affects the body. Let's look at what he calls the consent paradox and its direct causal relationship to the nocebo effect.
Okay, if you have ever been prescribed a medication, you know the standard routine.
Right. The doctor sits down, hands you a piece of paper, looks you in the eye, and delivers the mandated side effect disclosure.
They say something like, "This medication carries a risk of causing severe nausea, dizziness, and chronic headache."
Analyze that sentence through the lens of the LUP. That is a linguistic formulation with extraordinarily high definitional precision.
The propositional content is legally complete and medically accurate based on the clinical trials. The side effects are named as stable, context-independent facts about the chemical compound.
But because the sentence is so heavily skewed to the definitional pole, what happens to the patient?
The patient is left sitting across from the doctor with a massive canyon of contextual remainder.
Yes. The doctor defined the drug, but they provided absolutely no context for how those side effects apply to this specific human being.
So how does a vulnerable patient sitting in a paper gown on a cold exam table fill that contextual void?
Well, when humans face severe contextual deprivation in a high-stakes environment, their interpretive default is threat detection.
They fill the remainder with fear.
Because the patient has no contextual anchor. They don't know if risk means a 1% chance or a 90% chance.
They don't know if the nausea lasts for an hour or a month, so they assume the absolute worst case scenario. Their internal narrative becomes, I am definitely going to be violently dizzy and nauseous.
And here is where Dietz connects the linguistics to the biology. This isn't just a patient being slightly nervous.
Right.
The alternative approach, which Dietz calls contextualized disclosure, completely flips the LUP balance. Imagine the doctor says, most of my patients tolerate this really well. In the studies, a few people had some mild stomach upset for a day or two, but it usually faded quickly.
Notice the structural shift there. The doctor has intentionally sacrificed exact definitional precision.
Yes, they're using highly vague non-clinical terms like most, a few, mild stomach upset. A lawyer would absolutely hate this sentence because it is definitionally uncertain.
But the doctor has drastically lowered the contextual remainder. They have situated the patient within a specific, highly manageable, and localized context.
And the biological result of this linguistic trade-off is staggering. The LUP dictates the size and shape of the remainder. When the remainder is large and definitionally stark, as in the first example, the patient's mind fills it with anxiety.
And the brain does not distinguish between a physical threat and a linguistically generated threat.
Not at all. The prefrontal cortex processes that intense anxiety and signal to the amygdala. The amygdala activates the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
Your body dumps cortisol and adrenaline into your bloodstream. Your sympathetic nervous system kicks into fight or flight mode. Your vagal tone drops.
This biological cascade, entirely triggered by semantic remainder, is known as the nocebo effect.
The patient actually experiences severe nausea and dizziness purely because their biology reacted to the fearful expectation created by the linguistic void.
The words themselves act as a biological trigger. Deitz is meticulous about mapping this causal chain. The words don't magically reach into the stomach lining.
Right. The LUP explains the structural shape of the linguistic input. That specific structure generates a specific type of remainder.
The patient's mind fills that remainder, creating a powerful, affective state, either paralyzing fear or empowered agency. And that affective state drives the physiological response.
It is a multi-step chain, but the origin point is entirely the structural choice of how the doctor balanced definition and context.
Let's look at another clinical example Dietz provides, diagnostic framing.
Okay.
Imagine a physician is reviewing a patient's cognitive screening test, like an MRI or a memory evaluation. The doctor has to deliver the facts. There are two ways to present the exact same medical reality.
Right.
The doctor could sit down and say, your screening shows some changes in the neural pathways that we want to look into because figuring out the primary driver is important, as many common causes for this are highly treatable.
Compare that carefully constructed contextual framework to a doctor walking into the room and simply dropping a heavy, definitive label on the patient. Your tests show you are suffering from cognitive decline.
The exact same propositional medical facts are written on the clipboard, but the contextual force of the language constitutes two completely divergent realities for the patient.
The first formulation builds a reality of agency, investigation, and approach. It gives the patient a role in a process.
While the second formulation builds a reality of helplessness, finality, and avoidance, it drops a permanent weight on them.
And as Dietz outlines in The Grammar of Healing, those different cognitive facts, agency versus helplessness, route through entirely different neural pathways in the brain,
initiating diametrically opposed physiological healing responses. Agency promotes immune function and resilience. Helplessness promotes systemic inflammation and rapid deterioration.
And even the physical delivery of the words acts as context, right?
Absolutely. Dietz points out that the tone of the physician, whether they speak with calm, measured confidence, or rushed, distracted anxiety, is not just cosmetic bedside manner.
The tone actually constitutes the contextual dimension of the linguistic closure.
If a doctor reads the exact same script of cognitive decline, but sounds terrified or hopeless while doing it, the contextual remainder shifts dramatically.
The patient's biology will react to the fear embedded in the tone, completely overriding whatever definitional comfort the words on the paper might have offered.
This is why Dietz emphasizes that the language uncertainty principle is not a metaphor in clinical medicine. It is the hard structural explanation for why bedside manner is a biologically active procedure.
You cannot communicate medical facts without generating remainder. And how you manage that remainder dictates the patient's physiological trajectory.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most difficult section of Dietz's work.
The burden of accountability. We are diving into epistemology and ethics now.
Because if this remainder is structurally inevitable, if it is a mathematical law of the universe, that I will always leave some uncertainty, some void, when I speak, does that mean we are all just off the hook?
Right. If a patient misunderstands a doctor, or a client misunderstands my perfectly crafted email, can I just wash my hands and say, hey, it's not my fault. Blame the language uncertainty principle.
It's the ultimate ethical question of the paper. And to answer it, Deitz first identifies a phenomenon he calls the directional drift of knowledge.
What's that?
He says that as knowledge is transmitted from person to person through language over time, it almost always degrades in a specific direction, toward the definitional pole.
It's like a massive societal game of telephone.
Exactly like telephone. When a listener receives a highly nuanced, contextualized explanation of a complex topic, their brain has to store it.
And to make it easier to remember and eventually pass on to someone else, the listener unconsciously strips away the complex contextual nuance, leaving only the core definitional skeleton.
Yes. The next person hears that stripped down version, strips away even more context, and passes it on.
This is why complex, highly contextualized scientific research or nuanced political philosophies almost inevitably degrade into definitionally rigid, context-free, highly polarized slogans as they spread through mass society.
Exactly. So knowing that this drift happens And knowing that generating remainder is inevitable, we return to the ethical mandate.
If I am a doctor giving a diagnosis, or a lawyer writing a contract, or a politician giving a speech, can I use the LUP as a shield against accountability for how my words are interpreted?
Deitz emphatically refutes this. He argues the exact opposite. Structural inevitability does not excuse structural carelessness.
In fact, because the LUP makes the generation of remainder visible, predictable, and systematic, it massively increases speaker accountability.
Think of it like understanding gravity. If you push a glass vase off the edge of a table, you can't throw your hands up and say, hey, don't blame me, gravity, pull it down. It's a law of physics.
You knew the law existed. You knew the inevitable consequence of pushing the vase over the edge.
Precisely. If you understand the language uncertainty principle, you can no longer claim ignorance of the structural consequences of your word choices.
You know that if you choose a highly definitional, contextually barren formulation like listing terrifying side effects without context, you are forcing the listener to fill a massive contextual void.
And if you are a medical professional, you should reasonably predict that human psychology will fill that void with paralyzing fear.
Therefore, you must proactively choose which dimension to optimize based on what serves the listener best in that exact moment. You know they will fill the gap, so you are ethically responsible for guiding how they fill it.
The LUP doesn't let you off the hook. It hands you the steering wheel. It makes the expert's hidden structural power over the communicative act suddenly visible.
And with that visibility comes immense ethical accountability. You cannot hide behind the dictionary definition of your words when you knew the context would betray the listener.
But Deitz also takes a profound moment near the end of the paper to completely reframe how we view this remainder.
This part is so beautiful.
It really is. Throughout Western history, philosophers have largely treated the gap between language and perfect meaning as a tragedy, a failure, a frustrating flaw in human cognition that we must constantly battle against.
We view it as a prison. We are trapped in this imperfect system, doomed to misunderstand each other forever.
But Deitz pivots, and he argues that semantic remainder is not a tragedy at all. It is, in fact, exactly what makes poetry, metaphor, irony, and deep resonant human connection possible.
Think about it. If language were actually capable of perfect zero remainder communication, it would look exactly like mathematical machine code.
It would be utterly sterile. We would transmit data perfectly, but we would feel nothing.
The fact that an expression leaves a contextual remainder is precisely what allows a poem or a piece of literature to mean something deeply, intimately personal to you based on your life experiences, and something entirely different but equally profound to me based on mine.
The remainder isn't a void. It's the engine of expressive power. It is a space where empathy actually happens.
It's where humor lives, because jokes rely entirely on subverting the unsaid context. It's where nuance breathes.
The semantic remainder is not a bug in the code of language. It is the absolute defining feature of human connection.
It is the structural space we intentionally leave open for the other person to exist inside the conversation. If we filled every gap with perfect definition, there would be no room for the listener.
What an incredible place to land.
Let's pull all of this together, because we have gone on a massive journey today. We started by ditching the 50-year-old baggage of the quantum physics analogy, freeing the LUP to stand on its own.
Right, and we learned that every time we speak, we create a linguistic closure that inherently, inescapably generates semantic remainder.
We explored the structural, inescapable tug-of-war between definitional precision and contextual fidelity, realizing that you can never fully satisfy both demands at the same time.
And we watched this theorem pair through the real world. We saw it distort scientific journalism, shifting clinical nuances into stark, context-free headlines.
We saw it animate the deepest, most intractable debates in constitutional law, forcing society into an endless cycle of choosing between the stability of historical definitions and the fidelity of modern context.
We saw how we navigate this principle every single day at dinner parties, relying heavily on unspoken context and cognitive relevance to carry the true meaning of our polite, definitionally vague words.
And perhaps most profoundly, we saw how the management of this remainder by a physician literally alters the physical neurobiology of a patient, dictating whether their body moves toward a healing response or a cascading nocebo effect of fear.
And finally, we realized that understanding this theorem doesn't excuse us from the pain of miscommunication. It binds us to a much higher ethical standard. We are accountable for anticipating how others will fill the silences we leave behind.
It is a profound, permanent reshaping of how we must view the act of speaking to one another.
It fundamentally changes how I will write an email tomorrow, that's for sure.
So I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on as you go about your day. We spent this time seeing that the most precise, definitionally rigid language actually creates the largest contextual void for the listener to fall into.
Right.
If that is a structural law of human communication, what does that mean for our increasingly digital world? We spend our days firing off definitionally rigid, context-stripped text messages, emails, and social media posts to each other, optimizing everything for speed, scale, and literal clarity.
Are we inadvertently generating a massive societal ocean of unmanaged contextual remainder that we are all collectively filling with anxiety, assumptions, and division?
Exactly. What if true human connection doesn't happen in the words we perfectly define on a screen, but entirely in the shared, terrifying, beautiful silence of the semantic remainder we leave behind for the other person to find?